This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Is it right for a male academic to study a community entirely composed of women? E. Patrick Johnson explores that question in his latest book, Honeypot, Black Southern Women Who Love Women. He collects the stories of queer black Southern women in an oral history woven together through creative writing. E. Patrick joins us today to talk about what he learned writing the book. E. Patrick, welcome back.
I'm glad to be back. Thank you for having me.
It's good to have you. Now, we've talked about this before. Not brand new territory for you. You wrote about the queer black men in the South in Sweet Tea.
Yeah.
And you've talked about queer black women in the South as well in an academic project. Tell us about the origins of this one.
Well, actually, Honeypot began with black queer Southern women, the more academic version. But I wanted to be a little more creative and performative with this version. And the allegory for what it meant for me to be a man doing research on women. And so creative writing became the venue for me to do that in a way that wasn't so didactic. And it was just sure serendipity that this notion of honeypot, which refers to a woman's vagina, and that was sort of a vernacular term that arose amongst the women, and this little bee, this pesky little bee, was nagging at me. And so that became a way for me to combine the oral histories with creative writing, but also use that as a way to allegorize some of the tensions that arose from me being a male researcher doing this kind of work.
Well, you write about, especially in the introduction, but of course then it weaves its way throughout the book, this notion of honey and the many ways that it's understood and is an important part of our culture.
Yes, I mean, I didn't realize all of the ways in which honey impacts our lives, and that sent me down a rabbit hole in doing research on honeybees themselves. And how, if it weren't for honeybees, we couldn't live, because they pollinate the plants that lead to the food that we eat, and that honey is the only food that insects make that humans eat. And all of the parallels between the lives of honeybees and the women that I did interviews with, you know, for instance, honeybees live in hives that are 90% female worker bees. They do all of the work. They clean the hive. They maintain the hive. They take care of the larvae. And the male bees, which are called drones, which I think is an interesting metaphor for the role of men, but they're called drones. And their function in the hive is to impregnate a queen bee from another hive. But they mainly just draw on resources rather than adding to the hive. And then after they are successful in their insemination of another queen bee, they're kicked out of the hive and die. So there were all of these interesting parallels between the life of bees and the women, and the connection to honey and our livelihood.
Well, so you can see how important and useful those comparisons and analogies are when you're writing about queer black women in the South or anywhere, but in this case in the South. However, it becomes a little bit dangerous, particularly because it is racialized, when we look then at what that means, what you're saying about black men, the drones.
Yes, absolutely. So there are some analogies that are that don't work, and that, you know, are a little tricky. You know, for instance, there's a way in which, you know, one could stereotype, you know, black males in particular being lazy and not being contributors. So I was really careful in the preface to the book to talk about where the parallels stop and start, but also, there were some really troubling themes that emerged across all the women's narrative around sexual trauma. For instance, I interviewed 79 women, and 66 of them reported some form of sexual violence or sexual trauma at the hands of male relatives. And so that's, you know, it was a very disturbing revelation for me. But also, again, going back to what I was discussing earlier, brought to the fore some of the tensions for me being a male actually collecting these stories, because in some ways I represented the very thing that it traumatized some of these.
Well, tell us how, exactly.
Women.
Tell us how you navigated that and what insights you may have gained having, you know, sort of taken on that territory.
Well, you know, I was naive about the experiences of some of these women because I am a male. I grew up, you know, in the South and in a female-headed household. And so I wasn't unfamiliar with everything. But some of the particular experiences, particularly around sexual trauma, I had no idea that it was so prevalent. And it really humbled me to learn about these experiences, but also it humbled me that these women would trust me enough to share them in the first place. And so I wanted to be very careful about how they were represented, because there's a way in which that whole narrative of surviving sexual trauma could be put as a part of a larger discourse about why these women are attracted to women in the first place, i.e. because of a bad experience with the male. And so having to navigate all of those nuances was, it created anxiety, but it also created a challenge for me. And I felt that using fiction or fictionalizing parts of it was one way to do it without being so didactic or too literal.
Well, let's take us to the first fictional scene of Honeypot. Two characters who we meet, and tell us about them and and about the location that you set us in.
Yeah, so Miss B is a trickster figure, and when we first meet her, we don't know if she's a woman, if she's a bee. You know, the reader doesn't really know. All they know is that she shows up in Chicago at in the dead of winter at the doorstep of Dr. EPJ. And Dr. EPJ is a very arrogant, bourgeois professor who lets this person or this thing into his house, but doesn't know why she's there. And pretty much is rude to her, but she doesn't pay him any mind. And then she, as he's about to kick her out of his house, she touches him, and then they are transported to the hive. And the hive is called Hymen because Hymen is short for Hymenoptera, which is the species that honeybees belong to. And she tells him that you're here to bear witness to my sister's stories, whether you like it or not. And so over the course of the book, the two of them travel throughout the hive, her introducing Dr. EPJ to various women and them sharing their stories. And then between those stories, the two of them are having conversations, most of the time fights, about various things. She checks him on his male privilege. She questioned whether or not he's really bougie. He's making all kinds of assumptions about what it means to be a woman and so on and so forth. But by the end of the book, I think the two of them come to an understanding, and the reader comes to an understanding about more about the lives of the women that they've heard over the course of the book, but also Miss B becomes both more humanized and also otherworldly. And Dr. EPJ certainly becomes more humble and less unlikable.
You describe Miss B as a trickster, a kind of a character, but also I would think transcendent is another word that comes to mind, one who is wildly and deliciously profane and in other
yes.
ways, you know, wise beyond human comprehension in her, and her freedom is something that's enviable, despite the fact that, you know, it is proscribed owing to the various levels of systems that she has to navigate. How much of Miss B did you know? How much of that character could you have written, or did you, before you collected the oral histories?
I couldn't have written her before collecting the oral histories, because she's ultimately a trickster figure, and her purpose is to teach Dr. EPJ lessons. So she sets up scenarios for him where he has to make a choice. Many times he makes the wrong choice. But it's a lesson that he has to learn, and hopefully that lesson is something that readers or even scholars who are reading can learn from. But she's also a composite of all of the women that I interviewed and the women in my own life. For instance, my grandmother was an inspiration for Miss B, because my grandmother was one of those Black women in the South who's very religious but also cursed like a sailor. Mm-hmm. And those, you could hold both of those things in tandem. You know, there wasn't a contradiction. She also has a little bit of my mother, who was a very proper woman, but also shrewd. And she's also a little bit of some of my Black women mentors that I've had over the years. So I could not have written her without the women in the book, but also drawing on some of the women in my own life.
You talk about some of the lessons that Dr. EPJ makes along the way. let's get an example. He makes a comment to Miss B about the dress that she's wearing that I think is a pretty good example.
Yes. So this is early on in their journey in the hive, and he is just conducted his first interview, and they're in a little town in Prentice, Mississippi. And the woman that he's just interviewed says to him, when you get back on the road, watch out when you drive to this little town called Mendenhall, because it's a police trap. It's a speed trap. And so the police will pull you over. And so I share... or Dr. EPJ, rather, shares this information with Miss B, and then says to her, but I'm sure you'll get out of it wearing that dress, because she's wearing a very provocative dress. And he means it as a joke, and she goes off on him and reminds him that whatever she's wearing, it doesn't give permission for a man to objectify her. And he's offended because, you know, he's a professor of gender and sexuality and feels like, you know, his feminist politics are, you know, above reproach. And that's a moment when he has to come to terms with that he is not above misogyny and sexism. And that scene is going to come back to haunt him a little later on in the book, when sexual violence really, when he experiences it firsthand, he witnesses a woman being attacked in a club.
Now, that was an episode that happened to Dr. EPJ in the fictional part of this. I wonder if E. Patrick Johnson, the researcher, had experienced a similar moment. Again, a man who is a Black man with credentials, and a gay Black man to boot, maybe thinks he has a pass in this community. And I wonder if you ever got caught.
Well, sure. I've made, you know, as Dr. E. Patrick Johnson, I've gotten called out a lot of times from colleagues and friends. I mean, not so much now, but certainly, you know, when I was a graduate student early on in my career, that particular incident that happens between Dr. EPJ and Miss B is fiction. That didn't happen to me. But there were other incidents when collecting these stories where, you know, I did have to check my male privilege. And, you know, one of them, for example, is a kind of presumptuousness I had when collecting these stories about what the women would say to me. And again, I was not prepared for the number of stories about sexual trauma and sexual violence. And they affected me so deeply that there were a couple of instances where I became very emotional and the women were comforting me after listening to their stories, which, you know, was very unprofessional on my part, but they really affected me in a profound way. And so one of the things I had to do with the character, Dr. EBJ, is make him not so much like me, because in the early versions of the book, he was a little bit too likable, and his revelations came too quickly, and so I had to sort of make him more of a character than me per se, and so that actually helped with the writing because I could sort of create things that were fiction, and have a more powerful impact, I think, than if it was just a one-to-one correlation between myself and the character.
One of the more interesting themes that come up in the book, and you mentioned it yourself, talking about your grandmother being a church woman, is the relationship with the church, an institution that, you know, it seems to me cursing in the church is the least hypocritical critique that one can make of Christian churches these days. But talk about that and the insights that you gained into this relationship, which can be troubling.
Well, you know, I thought that one of the surprising things in conducting the interviews with the women that wasn't true for the men was I thought that, or I was surprised by, the number of women who were not religious in the sort of traditional sense. Many of them grew up in Baptist, Methodist, or a Pentecostal church, but they disavowed the church very early on. So a number of women who were Buddhist, who practiced Yoruba, or who practiced some non-specific form of spirituality. But those who were reared in the church and remained there also revealed some really interesting dynamics. And one was this whole notion of the church lady. And our image of the church lady, you know, it's the pillbox hat with the veil, you know, proper and so on and so forth. Well, one of the things that I learned in these interviews is that performance of the church lady is one strategy for femme women, highly feminine women, to seduce other women. And one of the women I interviewed tells this story about being seduced by the preacher's wife. And they have a 6-year affair. And I was just stunned because it made me rethink all the little church ladies in my church.
Right. Growing but the costume up, is like, built oh God, into was... the set. I mean, that the
yeah,
whole,
yes.
Yeah, that it's all built into the structure itself. Wow.
Yeah, and it goes undetected because no one would suspect that a church lady would be a lesbian. But yeah.
Well, I've got about 30 seconds left. What's next now for you?
Well, you know, I'm on this touring around the country, doing readings and in conversation with other writers. And I also have a documentary called Making Sweet Tea that's about my book on my oral history on Black gay men of the South, and which has been a play that, you know, you and I have talked about before because I did it there in Durham.
That's right.
But now it's a film. It's a documentary film, and hopefully it'll come to North Carolina.
E. Patrick Johnson, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for talking with us, E. Patrick.
Thank you.